I always feel the pressure to find the perfect gift for my relatives. In this case, whether you're sending an unforgettable gift or treating yourself to everyday perfection, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. For me, I'm not just into steaks. I like all types of meat. That's why I'll usually get the Winter's Bestseller Pack. It comes with juicy fillets, chicken breast, pork chops, and even burgers. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. A family-owned company with over 100 years of experience in the meat industry. Save big on unforgettable gifts with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide and earn an extra 20% off select favorites during their cyber sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code YUM at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. Go to omahasteaks.com to get 50% off site-wide plus an extra 20% off select favorites and more limited-time deals during their cyber sale. And use promo code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product, fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You're watching a Highwire Media podcast.
Welcome to the True Crime Never Sleeps show. As always, I'm your host, Larry Lease. In today's episode of Fatal Fandom, we dive into the tragic murder of John Lennon. Before we do that, give me your thoughts on this topic in the comment section below, as always. And if you got any topics you want us to cover in future episodes, let me know in the comments down below, because I am actually setting up my topic schedule for 2026. And let me know if there's topics you want covered, and I'll try to fit them into the calendar year. And with that, let's dive right into today's episode, shall we? Mark David Chapman's life began far away from the bustle of New York City, in the quiet suburban sprawl of Fort Worth, Texas. He was born on May 10, 1955, the son of a U.S. Air Force staff sergeant and a nurse. His father, David Chapman, was strict, emotionally cold, and often violent towards both Mark and his mother, Diane. For a boy who longed for warmth and environment, a household became a place of fear and retreat rather than comfort. This environment planted seeds of alienation that would follow him for life. When Chapman was still young, the family relocated frequently due to his father's military career. These moves disrupted his sense of stability and left him struggling to form lasting friendships. By the time they settled in Georgia, Chapman was a shy and awkward child. Classmates described him as small for his age, insecure, and often the target of teasing. He developed an early tendency to withdraw into fantasy, building imaginary worlds where he reigned as a powerful ruler over tiny people he called the Little People. This invented kingdom offered him control and respect, qualities sorely missing in his daily life. This episode is sponsored by NordVPN, the fastest, most reliable way to stay safe online. Let's be honest, the internet isn't exactly a safe neighborhood anymore. Between hackers, data leaks, and companies tracking everything you do online, protecting yourself is no longer an option. That's why I use NordVPN. NordVPN keeps your data encrypted and your identity private with next-generation security. So whether you're on public Wi-Fi, traveling, or working from home, your information stays yours. Think of it as your own digital security guard, always on duty. And with over 6,000 servers in 60-plus countries, you can connect anywhere in the world with a single click. Want to stream shows from another country or access websites that are blocked in your region? Easy. NordVPN makes it happen instantly. I use it personally when I'm researching true crime cases and need to access archived or international sources. Keeps my work secure and my connection private. So here's the deal. Use the link in the description today. And at checkout, get a huge discount on a 2-year plan plus 3 extra months free. That's 77% off a 2-year plan with 3 extra free months. It's a credible offer for complete digital protection. Don't wait until your data ends up in the wrong hands. Stay safe, stay private, and stay secure with NordVPN, because your digital life deserves protection. Now, let's get back to our episode. Yet Chapman was not entirely isolated. In adolescence, he discovered two powerful forces that shaped his identity: religion and music. He became involved with a local Presbyterian church, attending prayer groups, and immersing himself in evangelical teachings. At the same time, like millions of teenagers in the 60s, he was swept up by the explosion of popular music. The Beatles, then at the height of their fame, captivated him. John Lennon, in particular, became an early hero. Lennon's wit, rebellious charisma, and lyrical honesty appealed to Chapman's yearning for authenticity. Songs like All You Need Is Love and Strawberry Fields Forever seemed to speak directly to him. But Chapman's inner conflicts remained. By high school, he was experimenting with drugs and alcohol, rebelling against authority, even as he remained outwardly devoted to church life. He ran away from home briefly, skipped classes, and struggled academically. His self-esteem wavered between extremes. He would sometimes boast to others about imaginary exploits, and other times sink into deep depression, convinced he was worthless. These erratic swings foreshadowed the instability that would define his adult life. Despite the turbulence, Chapman occasionally found purpose. He worked at summer camps and YMCA programs, where children responded warmly to his imagination and energy. At times, he seemed like a natural leader, spinning stories and games that delighted the kids. For a while, he entertained the idea of pursuing work in social services, but these glimpses of stability rarely lasted. Chapman's need for validation was bottomless, and when the attention faded, his anger and despair resurfaced. By the early 70s, Chapman's path grew even more erratic. He dropped out of college after only a short time, took out odd jobs, and drifted without direction. He became infatuated with various women, but struggled to maintain steady relationships. A short-lived attempt at suicide underscored his fragile mental state. Though he survived and received some counseling, his underlying issues remained unresolved. Like many who suffer with undiagnosed personality disorders, Chapman learned to mask his turmoil beneath polite conversation and occasional charm. A turning point came when he joined a YMCA program to help resettle Vietnamese refugees. For several months, Chapman worked overseas in Lebanon, where he briefly felt renewed purpose. The experience exposed him to war's devastation and offered him a chance to play a constructive role. But this, too, faded. When he returned to the United States, the same feelings of aimlessness and resentment crept back in. He began to fixate more intensely on questions of authenticity, hypocrisy, and the search for meaning. In 1977, Chapman married Gloria Abe, a quiet Japanese-American working as a travel agent in Hawaii. She was patient and supportive. For a while, the marriage provided structure. Yet Gloria soon discovered her husband's unpredictable moods and obsessive tendencies. Chapman struggled with steady employment and alternated between religious fervor and angry disillusionment. At times he seemed genuinely loving, at other times he withdrew into silence, speaking of feeling like a failure or a fraud. His obsessions began to grow, particularly his relationship with the music and persona of John Lennon. For Chapman, Lennon had once symbolized truth and artistry, but as Lennon's life changed, particularly his wealth and luxury, Chapman began to perceive a contradiction. The man who had written Imagine No Possessions was living in the elegant Dakota apartments in Manhattan. To a balanced observer, this tension might have been a minor inconsistency. To Chapman, however, it became proof of unforgivable hypocrisy. Fueled by his fragile ego, religious guilt, and growing paranoia, he began to recast Lennon not as a hero, but as an ultimate phony. This seed of resentment would, in time, grow into deadly obsession. By the late 70s, Mark David Chapman's worldview was narrowing into a dangerous mix of resentment, fantasy, and obsession. Though outwardly functioning, maintaining his marriage to Gloria and holding down odd jobs in Hawaii, his inner world was unraveling. What had at once been passing frustrations now calcified into a belief that society itself was false, shallow, and undeserving of the truth he believed he alone could perceive. At the center of this conviction was a book that became both his scripture and his justification. J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye. Chapman discovered Salinger's novel during this period of restlessness. Holden Caulfield, the disaffected teenage narrator who rails against the phoniness of the adult world, spoke to Chapman's feelings of alienation with uncanny precision. He began to read and reread the book compulsively, carrying a copy with him everywhere. Soon he began to imagine himself as Holden's spiritual twin, the one person who understood society's corruption and the hypocrisy of its idols. This identification gave Chapman's disordered mind a framework. He would cleanse the world of phonies by an act of destructive purity. As his obsession deepened, Chapman's feelings toward Lenin shifted from hero worship to rage. For Chapman, Lenin's wealth and status stood in stark contrast to the ideals he once sang about. The line, "Imagine no possessions," haunted Chapman, who fixated on Lenin's expensive apartments, luxury cars, and celebrity lifestyle. He convinced himself that Lenin embodied the very phoniness Holden Caulfield despised. Killing Lenin, Chapman reasoned, would expose this hypocrisy and elevate himself into the role of protector of truth. It was a delusion, but one he nurtured daily. His obsession was not limited to Lenin. Chapman's mental state was deteriorating in multiple ways. He drifted in and out of religious fervor, sometimes declaring himself a devoted Christian, other times denouncing his own faith as meaningless. He clashed with Gloria, who worried about his increasingly erratic moods. At work, he often appeared distracted, unreliable. Yet to many people who encountered him casually, Chapman seemed ordinary enough, polite, reserved, sometimes even friendly. This ability to mask his inner turmoil made his dissent harder to detect. During these years, Chapman's fixation on Lenin escalated into action. He began telling friends that he wanted to do something important, something that would make history remember him. He fantasized about traveling to New York to confront Lenin. At one point, he even compiled a list of other potential targets, including celebrities like Johnny Carson, Elizabeth Taylor, but Lenin remained the figure who consumed his imagination. Killing Lenin, Chapman believed, would not only reveal Lenin as a fraud, but also catapult Chapman into the spotlight. And his warped reasoning, murder was not only justified, it was necessary. By 1980, Chapman's life in Hawaii was crumbling. His marriage to Gloria, while still intact, was strained by his unpredictable behavior. He had quit or lost jobs, and his sense of failure deepened. That summer, he attempted to find stability by working as a security guard, but the monotony only sharpened his resentment. Around this time, he began to plan Lenin's murder in earnest. He purchased a .38 caliber Charter Arms revolver in Hawaii, and later arranged for ammunition to be sent to him in New York. These preparations were deliberate, cold steps towards the act that would define him. Yet Chapman was not a man of constant resolve. His planning was punctuated by moments of doubt and hesitation. On earlier trips to New York, he had visited Dakota and seen Lenin in person. At least once, he considered carrying out the murder, but backed away, overcome by fear and uncertainty. Each time he retreated, however, his obsession only deepened. In his mind, not acting made him weak, while carrying through with a plan would make him strong and unforgettable. Part of Chapman's self-justification lay in the idea that he was not acting out of hatred, but out of a twisted sense of duty. He told himself that Lenin's hypocrisy was a crime against the ideals of truth and purity. By killing Lenin, he would be serving a higher moral purpose. Much as Holden Caulfield imagined protecting children from the corruptions of adulthood, this self-delusion provided Chapman with a narrative that elevated him from failed husband and worker to an avenger with a mission. Despite his obsession, Chapman retained moments of clarity that revealed the depth of his inner conflict. He sometimes admitted to others that he was disturbed by violent impulses. He even sought professional help at one point, meeting with a psychologist who noted his instability. But Chapman did not commit to long-term therapy, and those who might have intervened had little sense of just how far his fantasies had progressed. Gloria, though aware of his mood swings, later said she never believed he was capable of actual violence. To her, his darker statements seemed like desperate cries for attention rather than serious threats. In October 1980, Chapman flew to New York again with his gun and plans. He stayed for several days, haunting the area around the Dakota, but once again lost his nerve. He returned to Hawaii, where he confessed to Gloria that he had considered killing Lenin, but hadn't gone through with it. She urged him to seek help, but Chapman brushed off the concern. Within weeks, however, he was back on a plane to New York, determined this time to finish what he had started. The convergence of his obsessions, failures, and fantasies now made violence feel inevitable. Chapman saw himself at a crossroads, either sink back in anonymity, a failed man forever haunted by his insignificance, or commit the act that would ensure his place in history. He chose the latter. With The Catcher in the Rye tucked into his bag and his revolver ready, Chapman embarked on the path that would end not only John Lennon's life, but also his own freedom. The stage was set for one of the most shocking murders of the 20th century. As Mark David Chapman's obsession darkened, John Lennon was living what seemed like a period of renewal after a turbulent decade that included legal battles, separation from Yoko Ono, and years spent largely out of the public eye. Lennon had reemerged with a new sense of purpose. In October 1980, he celebrated his 40th birthday. A few weeks later, he and Ono released Double Fantasy, an album of alternating songs that reflected their shared domestic life and hopes for the future. For Lennon, the record was both a comeback and a declaration. After 5 years of private fatherhood, he was ready to make music again. Interviews that fall revealed a man at peace. Lennon spoke about his daily routines in New York, baking bread, raising his young son, and rediscovering his creative spark, saying, quote, "I'm not interested in being a myth. I'm just interested in being real." To millions of fans, it seemed Lennon had finally reconciled his private life with his public persona. He was no longer the angry ex-Beatle or the embattled activist fighting immigration authorities. He was a father, a husband, and an artist with fresh momentum. In this moment of optimism, tragedy was unthinkable. For Chapman, however, the contrast between Lennon's public joy and his private resentment grew unbearable. He arrived in New York on December 6, 1980, checking into the Sheraton Hotel in Midtown. Over the next 2 days, he lingered outside the Dakota, mingling with fans who often gathered to catch a glimpse of Lennon. He carried with him his revolver, hollow-point bullets, and the ever-present copy of The Catcher in the Rye. Chapman was not an imposing figure. He was overweight, bespectacled, soft-spoken, the kind of man who could stand unnoticed for hours in a crowd. Few suspected he was carrying a deadly plan. The morning of December 8th began like any other for Lennon. He and Yoko spent time with Annie Leibovitz, who photographed them for Rolling Stone. One of the portraits, Lennon naked curled around a fully dressed Yoko, would later become one of the most iconic images in rock history. Later that afternoon, Lennon gave an interview to a San Francisco DJ, speaking warmly about his music and his life, saying, quote, "I consider that my work won't be finished until I'm dead and buried." Unaware of how close that moment was, outside the Dakota, Chapman was already waiting. In the late afternoon, Lennon and Ono left for the Record Plant studio. As they stepped out, Chapman approached Lennon with a copy of Double Fantasy. Shyly, he asked for an autograph. Lennon obliged, signing his name and asking, Is that all you want? Chapman nodded silently. Photographer Paul Gorish happened to be present and captured the exchange in a chilling image. Lennon's pen scrawling across the album cover, Chapman standing just feet away, eyes fixed on his idol. It was a photograph of fate, unnoticed at the time. Chapman remained outside the Dakota into the evening, pacing, reading, and rehearsing the act he was about to commit. At 10:50 p.m., Lennon and Ono returned in a limousine, pulling up to the 72nd Street entrance. Ono exited first, walking ahead towards the building archway. Lennon followed, carrying tapes from the studio session. As he passed under the glow of the arch, Chapman stepped forward. "Mr. Lennon," he called out. Then in rapid succession, he fired 5 shots from his revolver. 4 bullets struck Lennon in the back and shoulder, tearing through his lung and major arteries. Lennon staggered forward, blood pouring from his wounds, and collapsed inside the entrance. "I'm shot," he gasped to the doorman and concierge before falling to the floor. Yoko, stunned, cried out for help as building staff called the police. Officers arrived within minutes, finding Lennon barely conscious. In a desperate attempt to save him, they placed him in the back of a squad car and sped towards Roosevelt Hospital. Doctors worked frantically, but the damage was too severe. At 11:15 p.m., John Lennon was pronounced dead on arrival. He was 40 years old. Outside the Dakota, Chapman made no attempt to flee. He removed his coat, placed his revolver on the ground, and pulled out his copy of The Catcher in the Rye. As police approached, he reportedly read calmly telling them, quote, "I acted alone." This incongruity was shocking. While the world's most famous musician lay dying, his killer sat quietly, absorbed in a novel. Officers handcuffed him and led him away. He offered no resistance. The news spread with lightning speed. At 11:30 p.m., sportscaster Howard Cosell interrupted Monday Night Football to announce John Lennon's death. His voice heavy with emotion, radio stations across the country shifted instantly to Beatles tributes playing Imagine and Give Peace a Chance on repeat. Fans poured in the streets, some weeping openly, others in stunned silence. In New York, thousands gathered in Central Park through the night, lighting candles and singing Lennon songs together. It was as if the city itself was holding vigil. The shock was global. In London, crowds formed outside Abbey Road Studios. In Tokyo, fans gathered with flowers outside the offices of Lennon's record company across the world. The murder was seen not merely as the death of a musician, but as the assassination of a cultural voice. Lennon had been many things. Beatle, activist, provocateur, dreamer. Now he was a martyr, taken in an instant of senseless violence. For countless people, it felt like the end of an era. For Yoko Ono, the grief was immeasurable. She issued a statement the following day, asking fans not to gather outside the Dakota, but instead to honor Lennon with quiet reflection. She requested that there be no funeral, and instead organized a global moment of silence on December 14, 1980. At 2 p.m. Eastern Time, millions of people around the world paused for 10 minutes of silence, united in mourning. In Central Park alone, an estimated 100,000 people stood shoulder to shoulder, tears streaming. The only sound, the wind through the trees. It was one of the largest collective vigils in modern history. The murder of John Lennon was more than a crime. It was a cultural wound. A man who had sung of peace and love had been gunned down in cold blood. The contrast was unbearable. The symbolism undeniable. For Mark David Chapman, the act was the fulfillment of his twisted obsession. For the world, it was a reminder of how fragile even the brightest lights can be in the face of darkness. When police led Mark David Chapman away from the Dakota on December 8, 1980, the world was reeling. Reporters swarmed Roosevelt Hospital, where Yoko Ono emerged just after midnight to announce that John Lennon had died. Shock turned quickly to grief, and grief into anger. Who was this man who had robbed the world of Lennon's voice? The details emerged slowly, each more unsettling than the last. He was not part of a conspiracy, not a stalker with sophisticated plans, but a troubled drifter who had acted alone, driven by obsession and delusion. In the days immediately following the murder, the world sought answers. The press dug into Chapman's background, finding the story of a man who had once loved Lennon, then turned against him. The photograph of Lennon signing Double Fantasy for Chapman circulated wildly, transforming into a grotesque symbol of betrayal. The signed album itself, held by police as evidence, would become one of the most infamous artifacts in music history. Fans, meanwhile, continued to gather in Central Park, singing Give Peace a Chance and leaving flowers. For weeks, New York seemed to vibrate with grief. Legally, Chapman's case could have drawn out for years, a public trial dissecting his mental state and the motivations behind the crime. His defense attorney, Herbert Adlerberg, initially prepared to argue insanity. Chapman clearly exhibited delusional thinking, fixating on the Catcher in the Rye and describing his actions in quasi-religious terms. Yet, in June 1981, Chapman stunned the court by insisting on pleading guilty to second-degree murder. He claimed that a voice had told him to do so, and he believed it was God's command. Despite his lawyer's objections, the judge accepted the plea. There'd be no trial, no cross-examination of his delusions before a jury. Instead, Chapman was sentenced to 20 years to life in prison. At sentencing, Chapman spoke briefly, describing his crime in chilling, matter-of-fact tones. He admitted that he had killed Lennon to achieve notoriety and because he believed Lennon was a hypocrite. The court, the press, and the public were left with little closure. A trial might have illuminated his psychological state. The guilty plea left only the stark fact of the murder itself. For Yoko Ono, who submitted a heartfelt victim impact statement, The plea did little to ease her grief. Her message was simple. Chapman had destroyed her family, and he should never be free to harm anyone again. Chapman was sent to Attica Correctional Facility, one of New York's most notorious prisons. There, he began serving his sentence, working various jobs within the prison system. Over time, he became known as a model inmate, taking on duties as a porter, clerk, and later in the prison kitchen. He also immersed himself in Christianity, claiming to have been born again. Interviews and parole hearing transcripts show him quoting scripture and describing his life as devoted to Jesus. For some observers, this religious devotion seemed genuine. For others, it was yet another mask. In 2000, Chapman became eligible for parole. At his first hearing, he spoke of remorse and said he regretted his actions every day. But the parole board rejected him, citing the magnitude of his crime and the need for justice. Yoko Ono submitted a letter emphasizing her fear that Chapman's release would endanger her and her son Sean, and that granting him freedom would glorify his crime. The board agreed, and Chapman remained behind bars. Since then, Chapman has appeared before the parole board 12 more times, each time denied. The reasons remain consistent: the nature of his crime, the ongoing suffering of Lennon's family, and the fear that releasing him would reward the notoriety he sought. In 2022, at his 12th hearing, Chapman admitted openly that his crime was despicable and that he deserved to be in prison for life, saying, quote, "I assassinated him because he was very famous. That's the only reason, and I was very, very, very much seeking self-glory. The candor was striking, but it did a little to sway the board. Each denial reinforced the sense that Chapman would likely die in prison." The cultural impact of Lennon's murder has only deepened with time. For fans, Lennon remains frozen in memory at age 40, a man poised for a second act cut short by senseless violence. His music endures, but always shadowed by the knowledge of his violent end. Memorials like Strawberry Fields and Central Park keep his spirit alive, with fans gathering every December 8th to sing and reflect. For the city of New York, Lennon's death marked the loss of a beloved adopted son. For the world, it symbolized the fragility of peace in the face of madness. Chapman, meanwhile, is remembered not for who he was, but for what he did. His name is a cautionary tale, invoked as a reminder of the dangers of obsession, untreated mental illness, and the toxic allure of fame. Where Lennon's voice continues to inspire, Chapman's legacy is one of destruction and infamy. He sought to make himself immortal by killing an idol. In a grim way, he succeeded, but only as a villain in history's pages. The story of December 8, 1980 endures because it speaks to profound contradictions. John Lennon, a man who had sung a peace, was felled by violence. Mark David Chapman, a man who once admired Lennon, destroyed him in the name of truth. The world lost a voice of love, while the man who silenced it gained only a lifetime behind bars. More than four decades later, the echoes of that night still lingers. In every candle lit at Strawberry Fields, in every chorus of Imagine, in every reminder that art can inspire even as it leaves artists vulnerable. Lennon's murder was not just the end of a life, it was the theft of possibility. What songs might have been written? What causes might have been championed? What wisdom might have been shared in his later years? These are questions the world can never answer, because one man chose infamy over life. As Yoko Ono once said, John's death is not something that heals, it's something that continues to ache. And so the legacy of that December 9th is twofold: the enduring light of Lennon's music and the enduring darkness of Chapman's act. The contrast between the two is what ensures that neither will ever be forgotten. And that is today's episode of Fatal Fandom. Let me know your thoughts in the comment section below. And of course, if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. And, oh, what's that? Where does your money go? Well, I'm glad you asked. It actually goes right back into this channel, helps us upgrade our equipment, bring in new hosts, be able to pay them, and of course, take this show on the road. We'd love to do live episodes from infamous crime scenes across the country, and your support can help make that happen. Of course, it also pays off all the hosting fees and podcasting fees online. And no matter what you give, whether it's $1, $5, $50, $100, even a 25 cents, everything is greatly appreciated, and we thank you so much for supporting this channel. And of course, if you haven't subscribed to the channel, please consider hitting that subscribe button and hit the bell notification button to be notified of future videos. And thank you so much for watching. We'll see you next time.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.